Good morning. This morning I'm going to talk about the 19th case in the Blue Cliff Record, collection of koans, and its introduction. So it's on your program this morning. The name of the case usually is translated as Gute Raises a Finger. And the introduction was written by Engo Zenji, and it goes as follows. When even one particle stirs, the whole universe is involved. When a blossom opens, the world responds. But what do you see when no particle stirs and a blossom does not open? It is like cutting the thread on a spool. One cut and you cut it all. Or it is like dyeing the thread on a spool. Dye once and you dye it all. Now, if you relinquish the complications that affect you and bring out the treasure within you, you will find that everything is all right, above and below, before and behind. If you have not yet done so, see the following case. So the koan and the case in its entirety is one sentence. Whenever he was asked a question about Buddhism, Master Gute simply raised a finger. All right. So now I'm going to ruin it by talking about it. That's what we do here. Some of you know that case. It's very famous. Some of you perhaps don't. Cases, koans, are part of the literature tradition. The literature tradition of the Zen school of Buddhism. It's one of the uniquenesses, actually, of the Zen school, is its koanic literature tradition. And koanic phrases, stories, interchanges are expressions of awakened nature. They're designed to act as mirrors to show us something about our hearts, our minds. So, whenever he was asked a question about Buddhism, Master Gute simply raised a finger. It's interesting that that's the entirety of the case, and yet the introduction talks nothing. Isn't it interesting that that's the introduction to that case? So I chose this. I love it because I love the introduction. It's a fascinating case to me. But Engo Zenji's introduction I really, really like. I think the reason I really like it is because it reminds me the voice, the tone of it reminds me a lot of Hongzhi. And I love Hongzhi. You've heard me give lots of talks on the practice instructions of Hongzhi. He's a Chinese Zen teacher from many, many, many years ago. And this voice reminds me very much of those practice instructions. When even one particle stirs, the whole universe is involved. That sounds very much like him. When a blossom opens, the world responds. So, what do I want to talk about? I think what I want to say is that the introduction to the case actually reflects the case beautifully. What it does for me is it brings up the idea of call and response. A blossom and the world and the particle and the universe and a question and a finger being raised as an answer. Right? We have this call and response. We have a dynamic. We have an action and a reaction. And the expression of the koan and the expression of the introduction both to me speak of the energy, the kind of feeling of samadhi, one-pointedness. This is the eighth Eightfold Path, the eighth step. The eighth step in the Eightfold Path is usually translated, samadhi is usually translated as one-pointedness, concentration, absorption. It's a state of non-dualness. Non-dualness, when we experience not separateness. Not separateness, not two-ness. And our in the Soto Zen tradition, our Zazen is one of our formal gateways into the invitation to that type of experience. We observe the sensations of body and breath until there is no observer and no observed. There's observer and observed until there isn't. And sometimes we have fancy names for those experiences of one-pointedness, and sometimes we get very attached to the idea of one-pointedness, and we seek after it. That's okay. Do it. Why not? It'll show up or it won't. Anyway, this awareness is collapsing the ideas of space, it's collapsing the ideas of time, it's collapsing the idea of linearity, and therefore it's collapsing our usual ideas around cause and effect. So I was first exposed to the idea of cause and effect being seen as something non-linear when I was preparing for Zen initiation here at Zen Center. So some of you did something very exciting last night in this very room. Am I not right? I see you. We had Zen initiation, what's sometimes called Jukai, the receiving of the precepts, in this room last night, and we had 19 people take the precepts, make a formalized commitment to the path of Buddhism, and they're wearing new rakusus today, and they received lineage papers last night, and if you ask them politely, they may even tell you their Dharma name. So when I was getting ready for my Jukai ceremony years ago, Tim was giving the group, a dozen of us maybe, I forget how many, the kind of standard run-through of the ceremony and all the things it talks about. Oh, here's the precepts, is what this is mean, here's the ancestors, this is what this means, and here's this part about karma. Oh, I should probably explain karma to you guys. Yeah, well, I don't have much time, so karma. Well, it's cause and effect. Okay, it's just cause and effect, right? You know, cause and effect. It's what you sow, you'll reap. Okay, that's karma. And that's the usual understanding of karma, cause and effect, and that really, really works well for us. And he said, yes, that's the normal understanding of karma in the Buddhist tradition, and we see it that way in Zen too. But you know, we also understand that everything is both the cause and the effect of everything else. That was his sentence, and I know I'm quoting him word for word because that just stuck in my brain. And I went, I have no idea now what the world means. What are you? Everything is both the cause and the effect of everything else. So there's no time there, there's no space, there's the normal laws of causality are out the door. I don't know what you're talking about. What am I signing up for? Oh my God, I'm in trouble. Probably. Some variation on that. The funny thing was is it didn't arise, it actually didn't bring fear to my heart. It actually brought the sort of sense of mysterious spaciousness, maybe, of like, you mean there's another way things perhaps affect one another besides in sequence? Is there another way that we're connected with phenomena, experience, beside just things interacting in the way that I understand them? You mean there's another way of getting this? I loved that. It made for a very large pasture to me. So, in the introduction that Engo writes, we are told that the entire universe responds to an opening blossom. And I think it's important, just from my point of view, that we understand two things about that. One, the scope of that response. The scope of that response to the opening blossom. And two, the unconditioned nature of that response. So he tells us, in actually very few words, the scope of the response to an opening blossom is the universe. Everything. Every conceivable thing. It's infinite, it's unbounded, it's timeless, it's limitless. It's more than just the air that surrounds the opening blossom. It's more than just the bumblebees that move near it. It's more than just the passing breeze that borrows some of its fragrance. It's more than perhaps the appreciation in the eye of a passing person with a keen heart. The whole universe responds. That's hard to fit inside my head. There is nothing that does not respond to an opening blossom. Everything vibrates. So all I realize I have to do to prove him wrong is to stop vibrating. I invite you to try. Along with me. I invite you to try to not respond. Isn't that fascinating? Your non-response would be a response, right? He's totally got you. The blossom got you. The blossom got you way, way, way before your grandparents were born. Right? 1 million years from now, the blossom has got you. You're still responding. And the unconditioned nature of the response is just as challenging to put words around. I immediately go to our teaching in Mahayana Buddhism of Shunyata, emptiness. That's how we usually translate that. Conventionally speaking, it's a little bit easier for me to understand this as just the truth of interdependence, a way of saying that every conditioned phenomena is interconnected, it inter-is, that conditioned phenomena suffuse one another. When I start working with teachings around this, Tim's comment about karma starts making more sense to me. I stop thinking about the universe quite so much as discrete, separate objects operating in a linear time, and I start realizing that the web of interconnectedness, the truth of interbeing, goes beyond the limitations of discrete objects and discrete moments. And I start understanding that Tim's comment wasn't just one of those, you know, weird things Zen teachers are supposed to say to sound deep. He's actually right. He's actually talking about something that's very, very true. So a single thing is impossible. According to the teaching of emptiness, a single thing can't exist. There isn't anything that arises without everything else. So to make this a little less trippy for you and for me, oh, man, do a little exercise with me. I'm stealing this from Norm Fisher. I'm adapting it, but he does this neat exercise with us once. So I invite you to close your eyes for about 15 seconds here with me and just imagine, just use your imagination to visualize in your mind's eye this opening blossom that Engyo is talking about. Just visualize the flower in your mind as clearly as you can and in as much detail as you can. And as you are holding that image in your mind's eye, ask yourself what non-flower things that your image already includes. Perhaps your image includes the earth or soil that your flower is growing out of. Perhaps your image includes the sky, the air that surrounds your flower, the stem, leaves, perhaps other flowers, grass, trees in the background. Maybe your flower has roots, or maybe it's in a vase. Is there water in the vase? Is that vase sitting on an altar or on a table? All right. It's interesting, isn't it? We automatically include. We have to. If somebody says visualize a tree, you automatically envision the earth out of which it grows, of course. And you envision the sky behind it, of course, because those things can't exist independently from one another. Duh. Wow, everything that I visualize always includes other things other than that. Wow, that's very, very tangible for us. I mean, we overlook it, but it's very, very tangible for us. This teaching is much less abstract than we think. And we know intellectually that the blossom of our flower here that we're talking about today grew from a seed, so our blossom includes the seed, it of course includes the soil, it of course includes the rain and the sun and gravity and wind and oxygen and carbon dioxide and shade and insects and the seasons and the fact that this whole earth is turning. It includes all of that. So Hongzhe, in his practice instructions, in his very first practice instructions, says, we are told that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. So one way of looking at that is that nothing exists. Not a single thing exists. I have a fan. No, you don't have a fan. It doesn't exist. Or we can say it is not a single thing exists. The fan has to exist along with every other single thing that's ever been since the beginning of time. Well, perhaps that's what he's talking about. In this field, birth and death do not appear. So we have a very challenging time, all of us, I hope, I assume, because I don't want to feel like I'm alone, conceptualizing the scale or the non-scale of interdependent co-arising phenomena. We have a hard time with that teaching. Because honestly, our limited experience does not seem to show that the entire universe responds to an opening blossom. Can you feel the tension there? At least I do. I read this and I go, yes, I know that he's right. Some part of me knows that the entire universe responds to an opening blossom on some weird level. I go, yeah. He's not trying to tell me that to inspire me or be deep. This is right. And yet, the tension I feel is between that and my day-to-day experience, which says the opposite. I don't feel that my life is responding to an opening blossom. I don't feel that the entire universe is responding. I just don't. All right? In fact, my experience tells me that most blossoms are unrecognized, unappreciated, looked over, mowed over, ignored, unseen. Right? That's my experience with most blossoms. Thomas Gray, the great poet, in one of his favorite stanzas, a lot of you know this one, says, full many a gem of purest ray serene, the dark unfathomed caves of ocean bear. Full many a flower is born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness on the desert air. Man. I shouldn't quote good poetry in the middle of a talk. It's like, oh, that's good writing. Isn't that great? Many a flower is born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness on the desert air. Do we sometimes feel this way? Do you sometimes feel that way? Like maybe your sweetness is being lost? Or unwitnessed? Do you sometimes feel like your life is disappearing unrecognized? Or unappreciated? I feel that way a lot. I feel that way a lot. I project that feeling onto people that I love a lot. When I met my wife, I was already at a stage in my life when I fully had never expected to ever, no, I'm just going to do Zen, thank you. But, you know, life laughs at such things, and you meet somebody later in life, and I fell deeply in love. And one of the things I remember thinking about a lot, in fact, I still do, is who she was before I met her. And how somehow I loved that person, but I didn't know them, so that's impossible. And I remember actually feeling like a sense of sort of poignant, I don't know, it's not quite heartbreak, there's just sort of a strange, poignant feeling of you were here in this space living this amazing life unwitnessed. You were amazing, and there wasn't anybody there to just go, my God, you're amazing. Look at you. Look at how smart you are, and how wise you are, and how hard you try to help, and how kind you are, and how beautiful you are. You were unwitnessed. And it always made me think of that Thomas Gray poem, like you were just there blooming. Why were you just surrounded by a whole universe just yelling at you moment after moment, you're amazing, you're amazing. Do you realize? Do you realize? Do you realize? Right? Shouldn't, you know, in the Jewish tradition, darn, I forget where it's from. I forget. Every blade of grass has an angel that leans over it saying, grow, grow. And I need every blade of grass. Grow, grow. Right? That there's somebody there rooting for you. There's somebody there witnessing your life. There's somebody there appreciating it, valuing it. I think we ache for that because we so want that for ourselves. We so want to have the experience of knowing my life is a flower that's blooming and the entire universe is responding to it. The entire universe. Not just people going, wow, you did a great job. But the walls and the trees and the light and the dark. That everything is there just saying, I'm here. That the call is me and the response is everything. And the call is everything and the response is me. I don't want to have that in my head. I want to have that in my my felt experience. I want to know that in my heart. So this brings up a classic and timeless spiritual question that is of great value to us to sit with. It is a fundamental spiritual question. If a blossom blooms in the desert and no one ever sees it, or smells it, or appreciates it, or even ever knows of its existence, does it matter? Does it count? That's a pretty fundamental spiritual question, isn't it? You know? Would I still donate the same amount of money to charity if I knew no one would ever know that I did it? Would I sit zazen every single day, even if I knew beyond any doubt I will never attain anything? No enlightenment for you. Would I still do zazen? What if nobody at Zen Center or in the larger Buddhist community ever knew that I sat zazen? Isn't that interesting? It really throws us up against something. Because appreciation, the idea of appreciating others and being appreciated, is so important to us. It's a deep human need to be seen, heard, valued, recognized, loved, right? Cherished. This is deep human need. And yet, if we aren't careful, our egos can co-opt this. It becomes currency. It can become currency. We have to be very careful about how our expectations, how quickly we can attach value to being appreciated and start doing things to that end. I sat zazen today so that later I could tell Tim, so that Tim could say, well done. So appreciation is all of a sudden currency. It had nothing to do with zazen. Zazen schmazen, man, it's a means to an end. I will only plant flowers where they will be appreciated. Wow. Isn't that interesting? Even my example of my wife, you can almost feel there's a little hubris in there. Like, now that I'm around to appreciate you. Right? Well, who do I think I am? Well, does that have any impact whatsoever? If someone is there to appreciate that flower or not appreciate that flower, what's actually going on there? This is a really good question for us to play with. So, we can play with these ideas in our head, and I think it's important we do it. I prefer to play with these ideas down in my heart, in my body. That's where Zen seems to get done. So we follow Engo Zenji's advice, and we relinquish our complications. That's his phrase. Relinquish our complications. Now we start to feel something. We can even begin to savor something or know something. And we start seeing perhaps the question isn't, does it matter? That flower that's never seen, heard, or smelled, does it count? Does it matter? I think that's the wrong question. In fact, that's an absurd question. So we consider Gute. He's asked a question, he raises a finger. Was the answer given with the raised finger? Was the question the call, and was the finger the response? Or was the answer given before the finger was raised, when the finger was still curled, sleeping in Gute's hand? Was that still an answer? Is Gute as a teacher still a teacher when there's no question, when there's no student? Can he exist separate? The blossom response. The question answer. It's not complete. Those things break the universe in two. Right? To break it down that way breaks the universe in two. It rends creation asunder. We're back on the map again. And we've lost our way. So, I found this in the archives. On Friday, March 1st, 1963, Suzuki Roshi was giving a talk on this very same koan. And I'm quoting him near the end of my talk, because if I quoted him at the beginning, right? Suzuki said, "We are always too much concerned with the superiority of enlightenment. This concern is caused by a kind of self-conceit. We should cut off the complications, moment after moment, one after another, big or small, including such egotistical ideas. Gute's one finger always tells us when and where the thread of complications should be cut off. Now is the chance, right here in this moment. There is no time for anyone to use his mouth or tongue. Tremendous numbers of blind tortoises in the dark sea are landing on Gute's one small finger, one after another. There is not time for anybody to lift up another finger. Okay, so maybe that helped you understand the koan, or maybe it made it worse. I don't know. Tremendous numbers of blind tortoises in the dark sea. The entire universe responding to that finger, to that blossom, to that question, to your breath. The entire universe rising up, responding to the call of your life, your very first breath. You created the whole universe. Here it is, responding to you all this time. Isn't that cool? Isn't it cool to know that the response was there before your question was asked? Before it had words? Before it even... that it was there? The entire universe arising is this giant question. And your response, before you even knew words, was... right? So creation is the answer, life the folded finger. It is just waiting for your question to raise it up. It is waiting for you. So I'm thinking that maybe someday I'll be a teacup Zen teacher. The funny thing about Gute is I don't think we have... Do we have any other stories about him other than the one finger? I think that's kind of it. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But like, that's his jam. Got the one finger. And then there's another story about one of his students going, oh, I get it, that's the answer to the question. So then the student starts imitating and immediately gets his finger amputated. Yeah, sorry you guys, that this is a figurative amputation, it's a metaphorical amputation. We probably should have told you some of this before you were initiated, maybe those of you who are looking at me with horror. It is a metaphorical. The neat thing about that is, now I'm off, so come on, Busho, be good, stay. The imitation of the answer is, right, like, no, now it's dead. Now it just becomes the thing. Oh, I get it. Now I'm just tying the cat to the temple pillar, and I've long since forgotten while we're doing that. Now I'm just holding up the answer because this is the deep thing. I'm just imitating your deepness. No, now it's dead. Now it's dead. Now it's dead. Right? Now I'm just a robot imitating the thing. So, of course, we cut off that. We cut off that finger. No, that's not it. That's not it. I remember reading a story about Suzuki again, because now he's on my mind, about he was taking a bunch of questions from people at the end of a session, and he asked a really provocative question to the group of students, and one of them said, is it this? But I gave an answer. He said, yes, that's right. And he asked the very same question again, and somebody else gave the very same answer, and he said, wrong. Like, what? I just gave the very... But I just said the very same... Yeah, when he said it, it was right, and when you said it was wrong. I love it. Don't just imitate the thing. I mean, you know, no. The idea isn't to hold up your finger. That's not the Zen thing. That's a Gute's jam. Anyway, so I'm thinking someday I'll be a Zen teacher where my jam is the teacup, because I always have tea with me. I seem to be afflicted with perpetually being surrounded by some sort of tea-carrying vessel. And if anybody ever asked me a question, you know, I could just, that could be my thing. Here's my, right? It's funny, though, because the raised pointer finger is just as much conditioned phenomena and just as much limited and relative as it is unconditioned and limitless. And a teacup is exactly the same way. It's all here. And if I look past this teacup, I look past my life. If I look past my raised finger, I look past my life. I really see that. I really feel how true that is. That's such a waste. I see myself doing this every day. I'm constantly looking past it. I'm constantly missing it. I'm missing the teacup. I'm missing the car keys. I'm missing the smile. I'm missing the paper or the couch or the cloud or the grief inside my chest. I'm constantly missing it. Over and over, I just miss it. I keep thinking the thing is coming later. This isn't the thing. The thing is the other thing. What is it? I don't know what it is, but I'll recognize it when it gets here. But it sure isn't this, because this teacup we bought at Goodwill for probably a quarter. So this can't be my life. It can't be. This can't be enlightenment. This can't be the Buddha Dharma. This can't be eternity. This can't be God. This can't be your broken heart or your hopes or your dreams. It can't be. No, I missed it. I've missed it again. I miss it all the time because I'm so caught by my system of symbols. I'm so caught by my agenda. I'm so caught by my conditioned heart. It hurts me when I think of it. So I continue to redevote myself. That is the nature of the vows that the people took in this room last night. In a sense, that whole ceremony could come down to, I vow not to miss it. I vow not to miss it. I vow not to ever see it as other. You know? If I start seeing your broken heart as not my broken heart, I got big problems. Right? If I start seeing the teacup as only worth a quarter, I missed it. The whole thing went by me. I missed all of it. If I want to live, I can't afford to look past this. I need to look at the teacup. I need to look in the teacup. I need to look through it. I need to see myself in this teacup. I need to look down in it and see my face reflected in it. I need to ask myself questions like, what happens to my reflection when I drink all the tea? What happens to me when the teacup is broken and gone? So when we really see our lives, when we really see the blossom, when we really see the raised finger, when we really see the teacup, we see our whole life. We see the lineage of ancestors that those folks became part of last night. We see our face before our parents were born. We see strangers, and we see a small plane taking off from a rural airport. We see the kindest person we have ever met. We see a child's balloon, a moss-covered gravestone, the open and burning summer field filled to bursting with sunflowers. Buddha is there, Moses is there, Krishna is there. With your zazen, whether you've been sitting in this room for 50 years or whether you've never been in these doors before and are sitting here for the very first time today, your zazen, your practice, your teacup, your relinquishment of your complications is what brings out that treasure that he's talking about. It brings out your treasure, and without even needing to choose to do it, you offer it freely to everything above and below, before and behind. Just like he says. A wise person once told me, you cannot fail. It is always done. You cannot fail. So I invite you to go buy a teacup. Go crazy and splurge. Buy a teacup. Buy the plainest one that you can find. Go to the Goodwill or thrift store, Salvation Army, or whatever. Buy yourself a used teacup, an old teacup, a cracked teacup, a chipped teacup. Fill it with the tea that you like best and hold it up. And hold it up. And hold it up. And don't stop holding it up until you can't anymore. And then when you can't hold it up anymore, don't. Let it crash to the floor. Shatter, tea going everywhere. You will see your reflection there too, in the spilled tea. The teacup's life and death, your life and death. Can you find your reflection in your life and death? Can you find your reflection in the teacup, in the night sky? Can you find yourself in both what works for you and makes you happy, and in what doesn't work for you and makes you unhappy? Can you find yourself in both your joy and in your suffering? If you can't find yourself in your suffering, you are lost. If you cannot see your reflection in the puddle of spilled tea, you are dead. Buy a cheap, used, chipped teacup. Fill it with tea, hold it up. Please don't miss your life. Thank you very much. We have some time left. So if you have got some questions or comments or something you'd like to add to our blossom teacup conversation, this would be a good time. Does anybody have anything today? Oh, hi, Katie. What can I do for you?
You're talking about the vibration made me think of quantum physics and string theory.
Mm-hmm.
Science is discovering that we are all connected as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking of that, and I love the word vibrate for that reason. And I chose the word vibrate, actually thinking of that. Because like you say, on even the smallest possible scale that we've been able as humans to discover, the smallest scale, there's just movement, movement, movement. And I love the idea that it's movement, 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 and that it's not a choice. And the reason I like it is because, you know, we talk so much about stillness in meditation circles. You know, oh yeah, stillness. I found a place of stillness. Yeah, sure. Sure you did. That's true. But just so you know, the whole thing was just vibrating like crazy the whole time. So I love it for that reason. I love that reason.
I just want to add to that. I mean, I'm in a drum circle, and I'm playing a standing drum, and my friend drum is next to me. It's vibrating.
Yes.
I can hear it.
Yes.
I'm not even touching it.
Yes. I love that, Eileen. It's the, it's that tuning fork thing, right? Where you get the still tuning fork and you put it next to the tuning fork that's resonating, and then the second one starts to resonate. Isn't that cool? They say that hearts do that. They say that hearts do that. And I know that because you know how if you walk into a room of just people who are outrageously happy, you kind of can't help but sooner or later become outrageously happy. And when you walk into a bunch of people who are really grieving, your heart kind of starts breaking even if you didn't know the person. And I'm just aware there's just emotional... There's actually a term for this. Emotional, it's more than just response, it's resonance, that we respond to one another, is that when you're with somebody with an open heart, your heart begins to open. And you're with somebody who's closed up and angry, that you start to constrict. So part of what they talk about in engaged Buddhism, with being politically active, socially active, that kind of stuff, is to invite yourself to be the non-anxious presence. If you can be the person who shows up and is, for lack of a better term, vibrating at the level of compassion, understanding, being with the affliction, letting your heart break, you know, that we begin to change the container in which we are. There's one person here who's not anxious, who's not operating out of a fear body, and that other people are then invited to vibrate. Does that kind of make sense? Have you guys experienced that, being around somebody who just feels... Like, what do you like about them? I don't even know. It's not their fashion sense, God knows. And it's not that they're particularly smart and their breath is always sort of garlicky. But, man, I just want to be with that person because something starts moving in us and we, you know, do you have people like that? I hope you do, yeah. Yeah, I love that. And I love it especially because it's involuntary. You know, it's not like a choice. Like, I will now turn on the compassion switch and become compassionate. It's not that we can't cultivate and practice these things, but I love that my response to your open heart is... automatic. You know, it's built in. Other folks, anybody else have something they want to add to the... Oh, please.
The baby taking its first breath. So the child takes its breath not knowing that the air is there.
Mm-hmm.
And the air doesn't know what the child is just like.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a question in there for you, or is that just you? Yeah. Isn't that kind of cool? We don't know how to breathe, and yet we know how to breathe. And the air doesn't know. Yeah. Yeah. It also really collapses our ideas about interior and exterior. I mean, I'm very attached to the idea that this is me, that this is my shell. Here's like the boundaries of Boucho are what I call skin, you know, and so Bernie here is outside of Boucho, and then, oh, that chunk of air is now inside me. Okay, that's a comfortable little boundary I'm organized with. And then I start realizing, well, if breath is happening all the time and it's going to every single cell of my body, and it used to be outside, now it's inside, used to be inside, now it's outside, that line between self and non-self starts being pretty gauzy, folks. So, and the neat thing about what you're saying is that both those things are just part of the fabric of reality. They're not like a decision at some point the humans decided, you know what would be clever? That would be brilliant. If we could get oxygen everywhere, we could have some sort of system, like some sort of circulate, you know, thing, and then we could, you know, and then just, that would be great. So maybe when I'm in my mom's womb, I will develop, I'll just grow those things. Thank you. Was there something else back there? I saw another paw. No, but retracted paw? Okay. Carrie.
Two things. One, a lot of what you said reminded me of years ago. I had a mentor who I went to, and I said, I can't wait till I know what I'm supposed to be doing.
Oh, yeah.
With my life. And she said to me, you're doing it. And I was so angry.
Yes!
I'm doing it. Come on. I'm not.
Yeah.
It took me a couple more decades to understand it.
Oh, she's a good Zen teacher. And I so understand your frustration. I was told the very same thing and got just as cranky. Yeah.
The other thing is when you were talking about finding yourself in the teacup, finding yourself in the spilled tea, finding yourself in the crowd. And it starts to spin in my head. Mm-hmm. It raises the question, if I'm responding, if I'm a response, if I'm a vibration, who am I in that?
Yeah.
You know, who is really me? Because I can start to go ego.
Yeah.
You know, and yet I'm just a response.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. There's almost some ego bait. They're like, oh, is that all I am? I'm just like, without the call, there wouldn't have been. Is that merely, like, am I dependent in a sense on, is that kind of where you're?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm searching for myself in these things, what the question is, who am I?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that is the question, isn't it? Oh, yay, you're asking it. Oh, I love that you're asking it. Of course you were asking it before you were asking it. Call and response fascinates me. I think, Ben, didn't you give a call and response talk some years ago around using drumming as a metaphor, and African music styles as a metaphor, and I love that. I love the idea of this interplay, and, you know, it's funny when we talk about emptiness and everything's suffusing one another, and you know, call and response can start to feel a little bit like cause and effect, and I start going linear, and I start going, that call caused that response, and I start getting very particular about what those two things are. And so at some point, I love to collapse those things and try to reverse them on myself to get past my usual programming that perhaps the response creates the call, perhaps the call creates the response. They arise together, they are not separate. And it's convenient for us to think of them as separate, and as, like your mentor said, your whole life is a response. It is a response. And it's also a call, too. So, you know, living in the ambiguity of those ideas is part of what makes us spiritually mature. You know, our ability to not only tolerate ambiguity, but thrive in ambiguity is one of the hallmarks of practice. And the longer we do practice, the more we're able to swim in those waters with comfort. They're not quite so strange to us anymore. We start actually realizing there's a truth being expressed in things that are not definite and ambiguous or even self-contradictory. We're not quite so desperate to land, if that makes sense. So. All right. Well, that's enough. Thank you all for being here.